We are in Genesis chapter number 8, and I want to begin with verse number 6 today as we kind of summarize where we're at in the flood story. Now, I want to warn you again, I have tried to transfer the dates that are given here in the flood story, which are based, I believe, on a fall calendar system. I've transferred them over to the more common spring calendar system of the Jews. And my reason for doing that is to kind of be consistent in my chronological companion so that when you see a date there in the resource, you know pretty much where it's at on the traditional Jewish calendar system. I would recommend that you check out my companion. It's one of the resources on intotheword2020.com. It's a work in progress. I will continue to tweak it probably until I am no longer teaching actively because I always find a little something new that I want to add to it or some other footnote that I want to put in it to explain. One of the things that I'm doing right now, this time through, is I'm trying to put these dates regarding the flood and its duration at the fingertips of anyone that's wanting to study it and perhaps even teach it. Now, remember that at the beginning of the chronological companion, I deal with things like the Jewish calendar system and chronology itself, the ages of people when they were born and died during the time period just before the flood and after, because I think it helps us get a better handle on the movement of history in the scripture itself. So this is what we would know from the story so far, and that is on the 20th day of the 8th Jewish month by Moses' standards, that is the Exodus calendar that started in the spring, on that day they started loading the ark. On the 27th day of that 8th month, that's when the floodwaters began. It was on that day that God closed the door himself to signal everybody that's going to be aboard is aboard. We are now going to begin. For 40 days thereafter, there was water coming down from the sky, and there was apparently also water and debris and steam and magma going up into the sky as the old world was breaking up and being overflowed with water that would end the sinfulness of mankind and of the fallen angels that had been causing trouble from Genesis 6 onward. At the end of the 40 days, that would bring us to the fourth day of the 10th month, and that's when everything kind of settles down. The waters remain pretty much high on planet Earth until the 150th day of the flood. That's the 27th day of the first Jewish month from the spring calendar system. That's when the ark bumps up against Mount Ararat, or the mountains of Ararat. And it's probably because the mountains are starting to rise. Ararat was a volcanic mountain, and so it was probably growing during the time of the flood. And now it is tall enough that the ark itself is starting to settle down on it. And it will be the place, as the waters drain away, that the flood lands, or excuse me, that the ark lands, and from which Noah and everyone else is going to emerge. On the 214th day of the flood, and so that would be the first day of the fourth month from the calendar system we're using, that's when they can actually see all the tops of the mountains starting to peak out. All the new mountains, which many of them are much higher than the original hills, or, quote, mountains, end quote, of the pre-flood world. And I shared with you my belief, and it's very widely taught in creationist circles, that when the supercontinent broke up and the plates began to separate away from the mid-Atlantic ridge, they slammed into one another on the opposite side of the globe and began rising the highest mountains that we know today, the Andes and the Rockies and the Cascades and the Himalayas. All of these places are now peaking up out of the water, perhaps rising quite high up out of the water from the perspective of Noah and his family, who might be able to kind of take little peeks out of certain places up high in the ark. Then we arrive at the 40-day period after the last designation, which would mean the 10th day of the 5th month or the 244th day of the flood. And that's where we pick up in verse number 6 of Genesis 8. At the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made, and he sent forth a raven. Now, this window must be at the top. It must be like a hatch that was specifically designed to allow them to open it at their pleasure after the rains had completely finished. And now he uses it to send forth two birds. So he sends out first a raven, so something of that crow kind, and it went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. So the indication is it doesn't come back. And the last thing I suggested to you as we wrapped up yesterday is that this might be the beginning of the raven types, the crow types of birds, to become scavengers, which we know they are today. We have seen in modern time that certain birds that have been seed and plant eaters up until a huge drought or a huge change in environment occurs will then change over to become scavengers. They'll start eating dead flesh, dead animals, because they didn't have anything else to eat and they needed energy. And so it may be that the raven kind, the crow kind, started scavenging right here, because there would have been plenty of dead bodies still floating around, more than likely. But he sends out a dove from him on this same date to see if the waters have subsided from the face of the ground. The dove found no place to set her foot. She returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. And so he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark with him. So she becomes the better barometer, as far as Noah can tell, for whether or not the floodwaters have receded enough that vegetation has started to come back. Well, she can't land anywhere, so she comes back to the only place that she knows she can perch, and that's the ark. Verse number 10, he waited another 7 days, and again he sent forth the dove out of the ark. And so this would be the 17th day of the 5th month, or the 251st day of the flood. And this time, verse 11 reports that the dove came back to him in the evening. So she's been out there flying around in the daylight hours, but as the light begins to wane in the west, she comes back to the ark. And behold, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. And this is why we have the symbolism to this day of a dove holding an olive twig in its beak and it being a sign of peace, being a sign of, I suppose, good luck, good fortune, blessing, is because it was on this day that Noah and his family got the first clear indication that life, the vegetative life, was starting to regenerate. One of the interesting things about a lot of trees is that they can be uprooted during a flood event, and they can float around. But if some of them get the chance to be rerooted and not, you know, covered over with mud and things like that, if they get a chance like that, they can start putting out new sprouts. And that is what appears to have happened with whatever olive tree that this dove found. So she, no doubt at God's direction, brings it back as evidence of what? That the waters were dried from off the earth. So they know now things are starting to move toward restoration. Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. Now, what's meant by this, nobody knows for sure. It could be that he starts dismantling some portion of the ark up high to allow them to go out and on top of the ark itself, and maybe even start doing a lot of activities out there. You understand, these guys have been trapped inside this box for 251 days. They want to be out and about. They are, as we would say, stir crazy. They have cabin fever. And so that is going to allow them to get up and maybe look around and see that there's less and less water. Now, they've got quite the perspective because they're up on the top of Mount Ararat, or on the Ararat Mountains. And the Ararat Mountain, because that range, that area, is unique because it is volcanic and it sticks up from areas around it much lower and flatter. And so they've got a good panorama around them of what's out there, and there's less and less water. Verse number 14. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out. Now, that, I believe, translates over to the 27th day of the 8th month. And so that would be the 361st day of the flood. So almost a full year. Actually, it is a full year by the ancient calendar system, which would have been 360 days to a year. And that's on the anniversary of the flood start. That's when they know that it's over. And then God speaks to them. God said to Noah, "Go out from the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." So God now gives them permission, 1 year after the flood began, to begin replenishing the earth. The wording here is exactly that which we found at the beginning of creation. God wants Noah and all of these animals to make this their home again. It is a fresh start. It is a new beginning. And life spreads out from this point. Verse number 18. So Noah went out, his sons and his wife, and his sons' wives with him, and every beast, every creeping thing, every bird, everything that moves on the earth went out by families from the ark. Families here would be the idea of male, female. Then Noah built an altar to He Who Is, and took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And this is my reason for earlier describing the seven clean animals of all the different clean animals as being sacrificial and being preserved as three pairs and a spare. I am of the opinion, and that's all it is, and that's all it's worth, is that Noah took the pair or the spare animal of all of the sacrificial animals and offered it as a thanksgiving to God for keeping his promise to bring them through the floodwaters into a brand new clean world. And this is not a sacrifice for sin. This is what we would call later as a thanksgiving offering. It is voluntary, and it is because of the blessing of God. Verse 21, "And when he who is smelled the pleasing aroma, he who is said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man. For the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease." Now, God doesn't just keep this to himself. He clearly shares this information with Moses at some point. Perhaps he shared it with Noah or some other prophet in the past. But the only reason we know about it is because God wanted us to understand that he is not going to destroy the world by a worldwide flood ever again. There will be local floods, sometimes very nasty, but there will never be anything like this in the future. He is not going to wipe out the entirety of Earth's population ever again. And the cycle that gets established in this new world is going to continue with very little change. I mean, every once in a while there'll be some random differences, but this cycle that he describes here is going to be the normal cycle for the rest of the earth's history. Now, in the letter of Peter, he points out that the current earth that we're in, fallen as it is destined to be destroyed by fire. The elements will disappear in a sudden burst of heat as God dismantles this fallen, cursed world and brings the perfect new heaven and new earth into existence. That's not going to happen by water. It's going to happen by fire. But until that date, until that time when Jesus comes back, the day of the Lord occurs, everything else is going to proceed with a cycle pattern. Seed time and harvest. We're going to plant and we're going to harvest. We're going to plant and we're going to harvest. Some years we'll have a hard time planting. Other years it'll be perfect. Some years the harvest is going to be difficult. Other years perfect. Sometimes super harvests. But the cycle is going to be there. The cold and heat, the summer and winter, the day and night, all of that is going to keep up its pattern. Yes, we can say, oh, it seems to be hotter this summer than it was in the past. That might be true. Or you might say, oh, the winter's colder or the winter's warmer. Whatever you want to say. Those are environmental variations that happen sometimes because of man-made stuff, but other times it's just because things are changing on planet Earth because of other environmental issues. But the overarching cycle moves forward. We have summer, winter, fall, spring, day, night, hot, cold, all of that. Because we live in the post-flood world. Previous to the flood, it would appear that there was not quite as much variation in temperature. And the harvest and the seed time may have been much more year-round, where they had multiple crops because of the perfect environment, even as it was degrading. But now, totally different way that we do things. Now, this also fits the calendar system that I've been telling you about, because we know that in the ancient Middle East, they seeded their grain crops right around the ninth month of the year. And that's from the springtime calendar system. So these guys would have got off the ark just in time to put a grain crop in the ground. And then they would have harvested it next spring. So it's fall as they get off the ark, and they immediately start doing the seed time, preparing for the harvest the next year. Chapter number 9. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So it's a repeat of the Genesis covenant at the time of creation. God did not intend mankind to be just a few individuals. He wanted them to pair off and to reproduce, to make more. Because God made us in the first place in his image and likeness because he wanted a bunch of us. He wants us, for reasons of his own, to be his companions, to be his people, and he our God. And so 8 people are not going to suffice for God's intentions. So he tells them, start making more. Verse number 2, the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens until upon everything that creeps on the ground, all the fish of the sea, into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. Now, this is the change in diet that I've mentioned a couple of times previous. When God created humanity and God created all the land animals, and for that fact, all of the seagoing animals as well, he created us all as vegetarians. We were to eat the plants, the fruits, the nuts, the seeds that were being produced by plant reproduction. All of the energy we needed, all the things that our bodies needed, was available in that perfect structure of photosynthesis and plant cycles. When the flood happened, it changed the dynamic of planet Earth's vegetation. As you would expect, most of the topsoil ended up in the bottoms of the oceans. And with it, a lot of the nutritional structure that these plants would need. Many of the what we call trace minerals today, would have probably been available in much larger quantities previous to the flood. So God permits mankind to supplement his diet with the protein of animal flesh. So animals eat the now less nutritional plant matter, but they produce protein in high quantities and fat that serves as an alternate food source and a storage source for energy. So all of that is allowed. The Israelis will be limited for other reasons from eating certain of those animals because of problems. Most of the ones that they are barred from eating are scavenger animals or bottom feeders, and that could be problems if you don't prepare the food properly. But at this time, all animals are on the menu. God gives permission with one very notable instruction to go along with it. Verse number 4. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Now, the blood that we're talking about here is arterial blood. That's what gives all of us our life force. Is our blood is circulating, it's being pumped through, and it's carrying all of the nutrients that we need from different parts of their body. It's the mechanism by which our blood is cleansed. It's how we do our carbon dioxide exchange system at our lungs. All of that is because our blood is pumping through the arteries that we have. That's what gives us life. We are flesh and blood beings. But the moment we're dead, that blood ceases to flow. And there it is in the arteries. And God tells them you have to properly bleed any animal that you eat. Now, we don't discover until later what the proper technique for bleeding the animals out is. You basically cut their throat while they are still conscious and alive and allow the heart to naturally pump out most of that arterial blood. They would also then hang the animal and allow the rest of this arterial blood to flow out. So all of the arterial blood is gone in a properly prepared carcass for human consumption. Now, there's still capillary fluid. So if you like to eat your meat rare, sometimes you'll have that red fluid and you'll refer to it as blood, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the arterial blood has to be gone in order for it to be a kosher kill. And the reason that God gives this is going to come up in the next verse. For your life's blood, I will require a reckoning from every beast, and I will require it and from man. For his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. And then we'll get into this next issue next week, next time, which will be tomorrow. And that is execution of those that don't show proper respect for human life. But the blood of these animals is going to be counted. The arterial blood is going to be counted as part of the sacrifice system. So if it's a sacrificial animal, which you're going to eat, all of that blood has to be drained away as part of the sacrifice because that's your life substitute. If you're not offering it as a sacrifice, it's still off limits because that represents life. It has to be poured into the ground. So we've run out of time, so we'll kind of pick back up on this topic next time we're in the Word.